You're listening to Toi Manaho, Designers Institute of New Zealand's DCAST, specifically episode 2 of Outside In, No Borders, a series where we explore the lives, perspectives and reflections of a diverse range of New Zealand designers who live and work overseas. My name's Brendan Jarvis, your host and the managing founder of The Space In Between, a behaviour-based design research practice and the home of New Zealand's first and only world-class human-centred design and innovation lab. You can find out more about that and some of the other things that we do at thespaceinbetween.co.nz. With me today is our guest, Thea Betts. Since February of 2022, Thea has been the lead product designer for Rome Digital's Singapore office. Rome is one of New Zealand's leading full-service digital consultancies, and it was acquired in 2021 by Project 202, the global experience consulting arm of Amdocs. At Rome, Thea tackles business problems using design, working closely with engineers, other designers, product managers, and client teams to deliver and evolve digital products. She seems to be tackling these problems fairly well, having worked on and led teams that have been awarded both gold and bronze at recent Best Awards. Back to the beginning, Thea started her design career at Alfero in Wellington, working there as an intern while studying and then joining them full-time after completing her degree. After 9 months, she relocated to Auckland, where she would work on award-winning projects for VTNZ and Genesis Energy, amongst others. Outside of work, Thea is a design mentor on ADP List, where she helps up-and-coming designers to make sense of what can be a curly profession at times. A design leader on the rise, in 2021, Thea was selected to be a delegate of Google's Rare Leadership Academy, and just last year, she graduated from the Echoes Design Leadership course. Her website tells me she is happiest when deep in the design process, solving tough user problems, and also that she loves to spend an afternoon in the kitchen cooking up delicious food. And now I've pulled her away from those things to have this conversation with me on DCAST. Thea, it's great to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yes, and I've been looking forward to today, Thea. I think it's been a couple of years since we were actually in my lab where we're recording this, and I really enjoyed the project work we did to get together. And of course, since then, there's been some big changes in your life. You left New Zealand for Singapore back in February of last year, so just over a year ago. What was it that motivated you to leave Auckland and move to Singapore?
So it's a great question, and it's kind of a funny one because Singapore was never on the cards for us until it was. It was never somewhere that we had sat down and said, awesome, in a year we're going to move here, this is what we're going to go and do. Instead, an opportunity presented itself at work in 2020 where the Rome Digital office wanted to grow outside of its Australian New Zealand footprint and into Asia. And myself and Jake, who's my partner, he's in the engineering team, so we were sort of presented this opportunity to then go ahead and help set up the studio here and be some of the foundational members to it. So again, this came after 9 months in lockdown. I think this was late 2020 from memory. Lockdown, we were stuck in New Zealand. We were kind of unable to go anywhere. We'd started thinking about what may life look like after the pandemic. Did we want to travel? Did we want to move overseas? Sprouted out ideas around maybe we go hang out on a vineyard in Italy somewhere and see where life takes us. And then this opportunity came up. So it's awesome to be here. And little did we know, we'd end up in an even smaller apartment than the one that we spent the 2 years of lockdown in.
Well, you win some and you lose some, Thea, it sounds like. You know, Singapore is quite different to a vineyard in Italy, right? This is quite an intense city. If people have travelled there, which I'm imagining some of our listeners will have, they will know just how busy and alive the city is in Singapore. So cast your mind back to just over a year ago when you first arrived there. Other than that sort of wall of humidity that hits you when you leave the airport, what was the most striking cultural difference that you noticed or that you had to get used to, that you had to contend with when you first arrived?
Yeah, it's funny you say the humidity. I think at the moment it's 34 degrees, and prior to moving here, I never thought that would be a bad thing. But here we are in 34 degree heat. The sun is shining almost every day. And it is definitely at the uncomfortable end at times, but yes, lots of sunshine here. So I guess when it coming back to cultural differences, so there's definitely a language difference here. So a lot of the locals will talk in Singlish, which is a colloquial form of English spoken here. So there are a lot of terms around sort of getting familiar back in the early days of can and cannot. There were not necessarily full sentences. It was not, oh, yes, I can help you, or oh, no, I can't. Someone, I think, were in a supermarket quite early on, and there was an experience where we were looking for, I can't even remember what it was. Maybe it was a shampoo, or maybe it was a, I don't know, flower or something like that. We went up to the staff and sort of asked how we could, where we'd find this. Didn't know, found ourselves in a strange supermarket. The response was, cannot. And then they kind of turned, walked away, and that was sort of that. And we're like, okay, this is very different mannerisms, but that's quite normal here. So I think just understanding a new normal for us was a big one, and realizing, I guess, especially coming from New Zealand, where you say hello when you walk past someone on the mountain, where you say thank you to the bus driver in a city where it's, what, 4 or 5 million people across all of New Zealand. That's that same size, about 5 to 6 million, is in the size of Auckland here. So it's a much more dense environment. And a lot of kind of the Kiwi colloquialisms like that of saying hello to everyone you walk past don't exist here because there's just so many people.
Have you found yourself saying cannot to people?
Probably too often. I do have to check myself every time on a Slack message or something. If someone's asking for something, it cannot. And then I'm like, hold on, let's rethink what we're saying here.
How does that translate into the way that you communicate with clients? Because cannot is not really, as far as my experience, has been a phrase or a way of communicating with clients back in New Zealand that would go down particularly well.
I think it's an interesting one in terms of different clients, and I think this goes back to sort of once you've built that foundational relationship with a client, you can kind of get away, not with a lot, but that conversation is a lot more personal and human as it would be talking to a friend. Going back to the relationship side of things, I think it will depend on the relationship that you've built with the client, similar to it would in New Zealand. And I think those terms will come out over time, maybe not in the first meeting, maybe not in the introductions, but again, as you sort of develop and build that relationship, as that engagement lengthens and deepens, then absolutely, I think it would be.
So tell me, you turn up there in Singapore in February last year. You have the big task ahead of you of setting up and being a founding member of Rome's Singapore office. Did you know what you're really walking into? Did you have any idea what to expect? You know, some of these things that you were confronted with, for example, with the language when you first arrived, was there a sort of 101 guide of, you know, how to live and work in Singapore that you were primed on? Or has this all been such a fresh experience and something that you've had to just be, I suppose, flexible enough to adapt to the circumstances as they've come up?
Definitely the latter in that regard. So I think going back to moving to Singapore in the first place, right? I had spent 8 hours here prior to making the move on an airport layover on my way to Europe 5-6 years ago. So, and it's been a little bit of time in Asia, but not a substantial time. So there was a lot to learn. There is no, I don't think there is a crash course or there is a guidebook that you can pick up and read. I do know some of my colleagues and various people, friends beforehand, would try to say, oh, watch out for this or have a look at this. I know some of the, for example, some of the laws here, right? There's no chewing gum. So it's illegal to have chewing gum here. Yeah, there are a few various rules and laws here around no chewing gum and that people warn you about and kind of pre-talk about. Singlish was one that I sort of knew there was another language here, knew it was a great city, knew there was a humidity there to it. But again, not kind of, I think a lot of it has been learned on the job or just through daily interactions of understanding and unpacking everything and the differences of life here.
So thinking about the job, you were obviously a practicing designer in New Zealand mm-hmm. for around a decade, and we have a certain way of doing things, right? Like not just our work culture, but there's a certain, I suppose, design sensibility that different countries, different disciplines, different, you know, types of designers have when they bring that to their work. So I'm curious to know just how well, if at all, your design sensibilities traveled? You know, when you arrived in Singapore and you've been there now for a year, how has your perspective on design or perhaps your practice changed since you've been there?
There's definitely been a few differences. So some of them, and I'll come back to all of these. So white space is probably a big one. So in a lot of Asian design, it is very busy. It is chaos. There is a lot of screen on that small real estate, which I guess in a way goes against everything we've been taught. So all the way through from university to my first role, I remember being told that sort of, you know, you need minimum of 8+ padding here. It should be ideally 24 pixels here. 12 is probably the smallest you could go, but ideally 14, 16 for a font size. Sitting in design critiques where you'd add extra white space and kind of, oh, you know, just add a bit more here, kind of make it a bit more roomy or a bit spacious. So really let that design and the typography sing. So that's probably one of the big observations I've noticed is from how I perceive design in a, I guess, Western context or in a New Zealand context. Lots of white space, big type in that sense, really letting things breathe, which kind of goes against all everything I've learned here, where it's, okay, 12 points a great size, let's try and get some more promotions on that, let's add, or we need all of the actions on the first view, right? So if you look at some of the super apps, which I'll come back to later, is another big trend here, but a lot of the super apps and banks, utilities are really focused on making sure that that mobile space or space is utilized, and this tends to be the trend across Asia. So taking some of the super apps and kind of those experiences, two of them that come to mind are Lazada or Shopee. Grab's another one, which I'll talk about soon, but Lazada and Shopee are these e-commerce platforms. So there are lots of animations, there are lots of banners, there are kind of, within these platforms, there are maybe 5 or 6 sub-brands which are all accessible within the first third of the mobile real estate. You've got kind of small 8 to 10 point fonts used, flashing colors, transitions, animations to really get as much as you can on the screen. So this was a big, I guess, shift for me as a designer and I guess as a person interacting with these applications to kind of feel quite overwhelmed when I first got them. Since kind of, and we'll use some of these probably on a daily to weekly basis, I kind of now know how to navigate them. It's probably about 90% of the features I don't use in a lot of these applications, but I know how to get to where I need to now, and I've kind of learned and adjusted in that sense.
So you mentioned super apps, and that's not something other than what I learned as part of my preparation for our conversation today. That's not really something that I was aware of before. We don't have those apps, as far as I know, in New Zealand. You mentioned a few of those there. I wondered if you could just go into a little bit of detail and just describe for our listeners today just what are those super apps? You know, what are you using them for? How are they different to what we experience here in New Zealand? You know, what's this whole super app space about?
Yeah, so super apps, or as I like to kind of coin them, as super experiences, right? It's going back to the heart, is it's one application for a mini or an ecosystem of experiences within that. So yeah, what it kind of means at the essence is that you have a brand. So I'll use Grab as an example, which is, I guess, the kind of Uber of Asia in a way. So rather than just doing ride sharing, which is where they started, they've now offered a plethora of services. So they have, you can hail a ride, you can order dinner, stock up on your groceries. So those might be kind of the more normal experiences from an Uber or Uber Eats perspective that you can do, although they have gone further than that. So you can actually get rewards for clothes shopping, you could order a COVID test or kind of book doctor's appointments all through the same interface. You can book experiences, and then they've recently launched into payments as well. So you can have a physical Grab Pay card, you can top up your wallet, which you can spend online or in stores with QR codes, which is another big difference that we've noticed here is the QR code payment system. You can get loans and invest. So there's a lot of these features within this one, I guess, starting point compared to, I think, in the Western world and sort of what I'm used to back home, is you'd have your banking app and that would just do your banking products. You'd have your grocery app and that would just do your groceries. You would have your doctor's experience and that would just do your doctor. So these industries, or I guess businesses, didn't cross-pollinate as much. And that's probably the big difference you see here with super apps, is it's one entry point into multiple services.
I'm not expecting that you'll have, you know, the world's most complete answer to this next question, but given that you've been on the ground there for a year, what is it that you suspect is different in Singapore specifically, but perhaps more broadly in Asia, that is enabling this or is attracting people to this idea of having a single app instead of, as you just described, then having multiple apps that you use to do multiple different things? You know, what is behind this? Why is this something that's a thing?
So there, I think there are a few reasons. One being convenience. So you do have that convenience of everything in one location, everything in one place, which is something that I think from a Southeast Asia perspective, they really enjoy. There's a recent Google study, I think about 75% of people prefer to have a single app with multiple functions and features. They didn't want to have to go into 10 different apps. They wanted to go into one. I think also the size and scale of Singapore. So again, as I mentioned before, it's kind of the size of New Zealand, the population of New Zealand in the space of Auckland. So that's only Singapore, and then there's obviously all of Asia in close proximity. So there is a lot of people, and therefore once you do have that user base, the ability to hold on and retain that user base is, I think, a key driver here with those super apps and super experiences, so that you can retain them and grow that user base as well and engagement.
You mentioned how you had to almost unlearn, now I'm putting words in your mouth here, but basically you had to confront a new reality as it related to the way in which you designed, the actual doing of the design work that you were accustomed to in New Zealand, right? You had to work with a much denser need, or an audience that was much more used to having a lot presented to them all in one small space. You sent me through a photo of some design work that you'd done for My Food Bag as a piece of work that you feel really, really resonated with you, or that represented what you're about. And that piece of work, which people can probably see on the Designers Institute website, is a great example of that. Lots of white space, really lovely set typography. Everything feels really well considered. Nothing feels jammed in to a condensed space type of design that you were saying that you're used to and accustomed to practicing. So given that you've had such a change in context recently, how confronting has that been for you? Like, how dispassionate, or how have you approached the changes that you've had to make in your practice in order to be effective in this new context that you're living in?
Yeah, so I think forever learning is probably the one here, is I don't have all the answers. We've only been here a short period of time in the scheme of things. And I think as a design practitioner, we have that ability to empathize and adapt and ask questions as well. So I think that's probably made the transition, at least for myself, a lot easier in terms of I used to asking questions, understanding the why behind things, empathizing, and kind of applying all of that to, I guess in a way, it's new people, right? It's new users and understanding why is it that we're using small typography? Why is it that we like this busy, crowded interfaces? And I think it's also what you know, right? So again, when all of the experiences that you grow up with are these busy, crowded, you know, everything's there, that's your normal. And I think that's been the biggest bridge for us, is not understanding a new normal, but bridging that gap between what we perceived and what we know as normal, or what we know based on our life and our experiences, and then now layering in new experiences and kind of bridging the gaps between those as well, and bridging the reasons why.
Speaking of normal, what you do every day is your normal. And while there are plenty of designers listening to our conversation, not all of them are going to be as familiar with digital product design and specifically what that's like for you at Rome in Singapore. So I'm curious, what does a day in your life, in your design practice, what does that look like?
Great question. And it is one of those things, I think every day is different, which is one of the reasons I love what I do, because it depends on the client, it depends on the stage of the project we're in, it depends on whether we're user testing like we did with back in 2020, 2021, where that was a week or two intensive talking to customers, working through the script, figuring out why and how they're interacting with the product that we've designed, and then what improvements we can do. So again, that's one piece of, and that was, you know, you were there. So that was a day after day, sitting in interviews, watching people use our experience. On the other side of that, there are other days where I might be sitting at my desk doing research, out kind of understanding and unpacking feature sets or how competitors are doing. There's obviously days working with developers, so actually understanding and bringing those designs to life to see how they've coded them.
Let's go into that, Thea. Let's go into that, because working with developers, if people aren't coming from a digital product design context, that's probably not something that they've done every day. And I'm mindful that your partner is an engineer, so don't say anything out of turn here that might, you know, get either of us in trouble. But what have you found when you're working with, say, engineers, or perhaps it's even clients that aren't as close to the design as you are? What have you found is the most effective way that you're able to translate the intent of the design and help them to build that understanding of what it is that you're trying to achieve through the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so at Roam, one of the key things we'll do is get our developers and engineers involved as early as we can in the design process to actually help us understand what we're proposing, whether it's doable, how we could potentially do it differently or recreate some of the things. So we have some amazing developers, and working with them early on always makes a better solution in the end. And it also means generally they will kind of question some of our design decisions with curiosity, and then also from a technical lens of, actually, that's going to be really hard to do. Why don't we do this? That's going to be a third less time, so we can actually get more features in. So I think there's a real balance between involving them early, and then equally, we are lucky to have some great developers who do have a design eye and actually will kind of really help make sure that the designs look like how they're supposed to and interact how they're supposed to in the final solutions.
Yeah, there's this. Sometimes there's this misconception out there that because someone's a developer, a programmer, or an engineer, that they aren't creative. And in the old waterfall methodology, you know, where designs were passed down the line and then built, and there was a little communication, it was pretty evident where the intent of the design was lost. So it sounds to me like you're working in what might be considered an agile way.
Correct. Yeah, I think you get much better solutions through actually bringing those. And I guess it goes back to diversity and inclusion, right? When designers are designing in silos, you're going to get great designs, but not necessarily the product or the technical or the business influence that you may need in that. When you bring all of those minds together, you get a much more diverse solution and a much more, I guess, robust end result as well.
You mentioned diversity and inclusion. And this is an area of the conversation that perhaps is happening more progressively overseas than I've observed here in New Zealand. And it's an area that I wanted to ask my guests about for this particular series on DCAST. As a woman in design, what, if any, obstacles have you encountered in your career in New Zealand and perhaps also abroad that some of your colleagues, some of your male colleagues may not have been aware of?
Yes, I think as a woman in design and also a woman in tech, right, it is a predominantly male-dominated industry. And so I remember early in my career working with clients who were middle-aged white men, to be stereotypical there, and kind of coming in as a woman in my early 20s. And just sort of navigating some of those challenges. So I was thankful to have some great mentors there, and great inspirations who were female designers and female leaders. But I think a lot of it comes back to, we learn a lot of ways of coping or a lot of ways around things. So whether that's sort of fighting a little bit harder, whether it's being a little bit more conscious of our mannerisms or our tone, because again, these sort of males don't always notice that. They can be quite direct and to the point, and that won't be perceived as bossy. For a female leader, being too direct or too may come across as bossy rather than kind of assertive. So it's, I think similar traits get treated very differently based on gender stereotypes, and I imagine also from a cultural perspective as well. So yeah, it's definitely a lot of that. And I think, yeah.
Is there any particular experience, you know, without getting into names or anything like that, but is there anything that stands out for you in your career as being a particularly confronting moment or a point that you reached where you realized that, you know, things weren't always as fair as they seemed? Is there something that stands out for you?
I'm sure there's many. I'm sure there's probably a lot which I'm not consciously aware of as well. I think it's one of those things that's very easy to not question or not understand. I have also been very lucky. I shouldn't say lucky. I've worked very hard across my career and always had some very strong female mentorships in my first role, which really helped set that scene. And then going into my second role at Frome, when I was one of the first design leaders, female design leaders, to be promoted into a tribe and the lead position. So I have had people advocating for me and seeing that driven and kind of potential as well.
Mm. Well, I did want to ask you about your influences, whether that be in terms of your design philosophies that you follow, but also in terms of the people that you feel that have been influential, perhaps, you know, extending past your day-to-day practice, but also there you were touching on people that it sounded like, at least to me, that helped to enable your leadership talents to grow. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone that you want to pay particular attention to here? Have there been people that you feel are significant in the way that you've grown and developed as a leader? And if there are, what is it that those people did or said or helped you to see or perhaps saw in you that you feel is the thing that's made the difference in your career so far?
Yeah, so I guess going back to my first role at Alfero, I think Caroline Jew was a big one here. So she was a female founder as well, so seeing her owning the business, running the day-to-day, all of those interactions was super inspiring. She did a really great way with people, and I guess also saw the talent, right? She built up a fantastic design team with the help of Corinne Bowie, who's another design mentor and now close friend. And so I think having these female mentors and having these advocates right from the early beginnings of my career was really powerful, and then kind of also made me see what could be as well, especially in a male dominated area. So they were able to help guide me, help, I guess, inspire in a lot of ways that whether they're conscious of or not conscious of that they have. And then also going into my more recent roles, definitely the leadership that I've had and that kind of inspiration from Chris Moore, from Lucas Coelho, from Paul McCree today, and having these people believe in me from the belief of into a design leadership position, and then that belief into grabbing the opportunity to come over to Singapore and sort of offering that up, right? So actually having, I think I've always had both male and female mentors and advocates there offering those opportunities and seeing that potential. So that's been really awesome for me.
Mm. From your perspective, do you get the sense that that job there is done in terms of the early experiences, the negative experiences that you had when you were navigating that world as a woman in design and a woman in tech? Have we closed the door on that, or is there still things that we need to sort out there as a design community? And if there are, what should we be focusing our attention on?
So I think in terms of bringing up the next generation or nurturing the current generation of designers, it's really around providing those seats on the table and actually advocating and allowing inclusivity and of everyone's thoughts as well. So I think one of the things I've noticed is Zoom, for example, offers a lot more equality in a lot of ways. You might have, there's no longer the same, I guess, space that people take up on a Zoom screen. There's also loud voices if you take workshops or anything like that we do, right? Like it's very easy to have one or two people dominate a conversation. When it's on Zoom, again, in this new post-pandemic world, a lot of people naturally go on mute and then kind of come off when spoken to or when requested to. So then there are a lot of those kind of practices that we can bring back into the physical world. There's a lot in terms of, if you look at a lot of design thinking solutions as a designer, kind of going back into when you're in workshops with clients, we will, in problem-solving workshops, everyone has post-it notes and Vivids. Everyone puts down their ideas, has space to think about these ideas, whether that's 5 or 10 minutes, and then sharing those back. So again, everyone gets the ability to share back. Everyone has the ability to vote. Think little things like that and making sure that everyone's voice is heard will particularly help, I think, with the juniors and but also the more introverted people. And so those quieter minds and quieter thoughts that still have very great ideas and sometimes the best ideas in the room, but may not have the confidence in themselves to actually speak up or to share those. So I think as a design leader or as a leader, there is that facilitation techniques that we can bring through into conversations to make sure everyone's heard and to make sure that we're passing the microphone around as well so that everyone has that ability to feed into the conversation and feel supported to share their thoughts as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really hugely important point. I want to come back to what you said earlier on about the female role models that you had at Alfero. And then more recently, I think you mentioned 3 male leaders that you felt had helped you to grow in your own leadership journey. Just how important is it to have males also involved in and conscious of and aware of these types of experiences that their female colleagues may be having?
So I think it's hugely important that males are conscious and aware of all the things that females may do, knowingly or unknowingly, right? So there is a lot that I've noticed in my career from my first internship all the way through to today that gets put onto my shoulders, whether it's because I'm a social person or whether it's because I'm a female. I'd like to think it's not because I'm a female. There's probably a bit which is because it's there, will take care of that. So whether that's small things from getting coffees and doing the coffee runs, whether it's organizing social events, things like that, whether it's, picking up printing or booking in workshops and meetings. So there is that, I think. There's a lot of additional little things that may naturally fall on a typical female role that I think, again, going back to having both male and female leaders is something we need to balance out, and it is something that responsibility should be shared. So I think there is a huge willingness from females to advocate for females. However, I think we also need the male counterparts. They need to be advocating for females as well. So as kind of mentioned in my later career, there's a lot of males that are advocating in that sense. And I think we need to make sure that that's happening across the board as well.
I think I remember reading something around domestic responsibilities, and this is going back maybe a couple of years, so my reference is a little hazy, but it was basically talking about the emotional labour or the load that is placed primarily on women in the household when it comes to all the things that sit outside of our lives. And it sounds like what you're saying there is that those roles are played out in the work environment as well, and that we need to be mindful of those, you know, like you were saying, getting the coffees. I'm sure you've done other things at work, given your skill with baking and other things that have sort of fallen on your shoulders, and that we just need to be more mindful of those.
Absolutely.
What was it that led you to design? So taking a completely different direction here, like how did you end up wanting to be what you are now? Is this something that just occurred to you and you found it naturally, or is this something that's been like a burning desire of yours since a young age?
So let's going back to design. Why design? I don't think I ever made a conscious choice around design until I was applying for a university degree. That being said, I think there were a lot of unconscious decisions in terms of I really enjoyed what I was doing, and that's what led me to pursuing it in high school with graphic design. I remember cleaning out the house years and years and years ago and finding a web design certificate that must have been made in primary school. So again, it's little things like this that they weren't ever conscious efforts, but I think always drawn to that complex and problem solving, and then using visuals and using, I guess, design and communication to bring those ideas to life. So yeah, I mean, back in high school, I was doing architecture and physical product design. It wasn't until I went to university where I've really understood a bit more about digital product design. This is all colliding with the rise of the iPhone and things like that. So when digital design really did take off as well, And I think some of the more memorable papers for me in university were around experience-driven design as well. So that was kind of the marrying up of from where I had been naturally curious to actually learning around this as a science as well.
We were talking before we hit record, and you mentioned to me something to the effect of that digital design, you know, this experiential aspect of design, you know, using technology to communicate with people and give them an experience, that just clicked with you more than perhaps traditional print design or graphic design did. What was it about digital design that you felt resonated so much with you?
So I think I have a logical side to my brain. At one point I was considering doing engineering down in Canterbury. So there is that I was good at math, I was good at science. That kind of logical side of things really clicked with me. And I think that's where something like typography and particularly print design, we were doing a lot of books and posters, and it was more around a feeling or a flow in that sense. A lot of it was more around every page should look different, but also part of a system, but also kind of not the same. And it was all a little bit, I really struggled to find that right balance of different but the same, but still working together. So I think that's where digital made a lot more sense, because there's a lot more structure to it. There's a purpose behind it as well, right? It's telling a story, but telling a story through delivering value at the same time and delivering business impact. So there was a lot more of a purpose-driven, at least for me, in digital design that clicked and resonated.
So you've done a lot of digital design since you started at Alfero, and now you find yourself in Singapore at Rome. What is it that has surprised you the most about your career to date?
So when it comes to, I guess there's probably multiple ways to look at that, right? So when it comes to digital design, I think the growth of digital design, when I was joining as an intern back in, let's not actually go there, when I was joining as an intern on 10 years ago, everyone wanted an app, right? It was the heyday of digital design. It was cool, we've got the service, now let's have an app. We were measuring to an extent some of the metrics in the business and the goals, and we were creating with purpose in that sense. But a lot of it was client coming to us going, we would like an app. What does that app look like? And so being able to be at the front of helping these businesses really make those decisions around what do customers care about and kind of riding that wave from that customer centricity has been probably, I guess, fundamental to my career and one of the biggest shifts now. Now we're layering in the business elements to it. We're layering in technology. Obviously, AI is coming at us fast and extremely quickly based on the last kind of 3 months and what's happened there. Compared to, I guess, I remember being back at Alfero, so 5+ years ago, the Oculus Rift, so I'm not sure I can say that right, the Oculus Rift and the Google Glasses, right? They've come out, they were this new wave of technology, but they never really hit off, and they haven't, at least in my experience, in kind of the app and the mobile phone, that's really stayed with us. The watches, the smart devices, that stayed quite true, but the glasses and the metaverse and this Oculus Rift, they haven't quite found their way into mainstream yet. Whereas I can see something like AI, which is much more in its infancy in many ways, really accelerating that growth with technology and human language processing.
So thinking about AI, that's clearly something that maybe in my little bubble at least, I have had many conversations about, and it seems to be occupying a lot of mind space of UX designers and digital product designers and anyone that's tangentially attached to technology. What is it about this last 3 months, you know, this rise of ChatGPT, of Midjourney, of all these tools that people are hearing about? What is it about this that has you curious or concerned or excited? You know, what is it about it? How do you feel about these technologies, these AI technologies that are coming out and what they might mean for you as a practicing designer?
Yeah, so I think this new wave of the AIs, all these new shortcuts, all kind of helping accelerate, right? So there's a lot in the copy space I've been looking into. There's a lot in the imagery space that's coming out. AI color generators, all of these kind of various tools and shortcuts coming up to help accelerate us as practitioners. And what I do think is it's an exciting time that's equally coupled with probably a bit of a scariness or a bit of an uncertainty, right? So where will this take us? Especially, I think there are ethical concerns that we should be thinking about around where is AI good? Is AI bad? How can we use it for good, not bad? And then going back to as a practitioner, I think it is more exciting than scary. I don't think AI is coming for our jobs. I think AI is going to help accelerate our jobs. It's going to turn our jobs more strategic because, again, there's a lot that when you know how to use something like ChatGPT, you can feed it the right prompts to actually help it refine the way that we communicate something or turn a whole lot of fluff into a really concise story or problem statement, right? So I think we'll be able to get through that iteration a bit quicker and help accelerate some of that process. It'll take up some of the manual or tedious tasks when it comes. So I don't yet see you being able to speak, design me a banking app and Figma spitting out an incredible banking app that has all of the strategy and the research and the customer empathy that we're not there. And I don't know if design and AI will ever get to that stage, because as people evolve, I think that's part of our superpower as design practitioners is bringing through that customer lens, bringing through that business lens, and actually creating something unique with its own value.
Well, that's certainly the story I've been telling myself to help me sleep better at night, given what's been going on. But when it comes to the practice of UI, so user interface design or visual design, the graphic design aspect of digital products, how confident are you that we're not going to see designers displaced by this technology?
So it's a tricky one. And again, I don't have a crystal ball and I can't see into the future. I think there will be elements of it that will be displaced. So, for example, whether that's timing of, you know, you set some styles and then AI rolls that out across, whether it's you, I'm sure in some instances you could put through the brand colors and the brand typography and get a base level design out. Whether that design is to the quality and standard you want to be delivering to will be of another question. Whether it's got that craft, whether it's got that uniqueness. So, for example, if you looked at 20 of the apps you're using today or websites you go to, you could probably spit out something pretty similar to those, but it wouldn't be unique in that sense. So I think that's where is really being able to challenge or build on to will become essential for designers, right? It might adapt the way they practice or adapt how they influence the designs.
Thea, when you reflect back on your career, what do you feel has been your biggest or your most valuable lesson that you've learned as a designer?
So I think design, there's two I'll touch on here. So one is design is about the people, right? So staying that connection, whether you are designing for the people, whether you are managing people, whether you are leading people, whether you are building screens, whether you are creating an AI chatbot, whatever you are doing, it all comes back to the people and the impact that has on people's lives. So I think that's one of the biggest threads I've noticed or biggest learnings is actually how centric people is to that and how central people is to everything that we do as a designer and in the design practice, especially with product design and my role. On the flip side of that, there's also technology. So technology has changed so much. So when I first got involved with design, we were using Fireworks, I believe, which was an Adobe product. Then we went through the wave of Sketch, which revolutionized that. Now we have Figma, which is doing that. Along the line, there have been Envisions, there's been Zeppelins, there's been Abstracts, there's been all these different tools that come in. The way I see where it's going is that doesn't make me a bad designer. It's just a relearning or adapting to new skills. And I think that's the key thing is the world is constantly evolving, and where we were 10 years, 20 years ago, it's just getting faster and faster. So as I guess one of the biggest lessons is we're constantly learning and constantly iterating on not only ourselves and our practice, but on what we're delivering and how we're delivering it.
That's such a key point. And I imagine that you're doing quite a lot of constant learning in this new environment that you're living in Singapore. Do you see yourself coming back to New Zealand?
Absolutely. I don't know when. And that's probably a bigger question, is when will we be back? But New Zealand is home for us. So New Zealand, I mean, do you blame us, right? Like the scenery, the landscapes, the sunsets, the food. The food, it might be expensive, and I hear there's a lot of rising of prices.
Very expensive now.
But the quality is so good, right? Like the wine culture, right? The beers, the craft culture that exists in New Zealand is incredible. So, no, we will be back. The lifestyle and the kind of work-life balance, the summers in New Zealand, you just can't beat it, right? So, like, we will be back. It's just more of a matter of when and what will we do before we come back.
Well, let's touch on that. I get the sense that there's some, well, there's clearly unfinished business for you overseas. What is it that you are hoping to achieve or looking to achieve over the next couple of years?
Since moving, our eyes have opened up to a completely new way of life and just a different pace, a different way to spend our weekends or our time, different experiences, both culturally in terms of sort of, I guess, the diversity here, the food, the kind of social activities, the concerts and things like that that are happening here. Singapore really is a big city vibes to it, which is exciting. I think there's also, as I spoke before, travel. So that's something that's kind of opened up a lot for us. We've done a bit of travel around the Asia area, so Vietnam, Thailand, and various other places. But I still don't feel like we've done traveling. Like, it is that closeness and proximity to different cultures is still really exciting for me and something that we just don't have back home in New Zealand. And then, as I mentioned before, sort of still that ability to go, whether it's Europe next or whether it's America, like, I think there's still more to learn from a cultural perspective, from an experience perspective, and also from a design perspective in these different cultures and countries.
So thinking about that, you've touched on some really interesting things there that I'm sure that people that have travelled will agree with, you know, those things that you can learn in different cultures. And in particular, you're in a hotbed of amazing places that you can visit being based in Singapore. So for the people that are listening today, the designers that are listening that are thinking about making a move overseas, given your experience so far, what's a piece of advice that you can share with them? Or perhaps it's something that you wished you knew before you hopped on that plane and left New Zealand that you feel is important for others to remember or to do if they decide to make that decision?
Yeah, so first of all, as Nike might say, just do it. So that's probably, if you're thinking about it, take the leap, pack your bags, book your flight and just do it, because obviously there are a lot of things to sort out around visas, jobs, etc. But from everyone that we've met, sort of no one has regretted it. Everyone's learned a lot, just being that exposure into what you will learn about yourself as a person, as a practitioner, I think is so, so valuable and something you can't do and won't do in a 2-week stint somewhere as well. So it's a very different way. That being said, it's challenging at times, it's exciting at times, and it's a completely new life. So from going from New Zealand, where you have all your friends and family, to abroad, you're now removing yourself from that. You're removing yourself from the normal and what you know, and actually, in essence, starting an entirely new chapter. So you'll meet new people, you're in a new time zone, the supermarkets, everything from the supermarkets to the transport to the food you eat, the way you spend your weekends, where you live, all of that changes. And so I think being prepared for change and accepting change and being curious with it. So I think one of our biggest challenges was naively, I would probably say, thinking that it would be like we were at home in a different country and life would continue the same. That is definitely not the case. So much of life has changed in terms of how we, like, even things around how we eat, right? The food that's accessible to us is slightly different, especially when you're factoring in cost margins. So, like, a lot of beef is quite expensive here, so we'll naturally eat a lot less of it, but cherry tomatoes are $1.90 all year round. So, again, there are pros and cons to it all. So that's probably one, is just embracing that change and being open and curious is probably the biggest thing. And then the second thing that I think is important for everyone to be thinking about if you are looking to move overseas is figuring out what you want from it and how that may change. So you might be reprioritizing your goals, you might be reprioritizing your spending, you might be doing more travel and experiences, you might be putting your career first. So that may all change a little bit while you're overseas, and just being open to and kind of, I guess, reevaluating and repurposing what's important, and then making sure that while you're overseas, that's your priority, if that makes sense. So I guess here it's very easy to get caught up in everything that we can do, but making sure that we're able to go, okay, but what's important to us? And that may be more travel, having meaningful connections, putting effort into work and kind of understanding the culture. And so making sure that that is coming out in our lives.
That makes a lot of sense. Thanks, Thea. It's been really great to spend this time with you. And thank you for sharing your story and your insights with the New Zealand design community today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, you're most welcome. And to our listeners, thank you for being with us on this episode of Decast, the podcast of Toi Manaho Designers Institute of New Zealand. Keep an eye out for the next episode of this Outside In No Borders series. It'll be out soon. And so now is a really good moment, right now, to subscribe to Decast or to follow it, depending on what you're listening to it on, if you haven't done so already. If you've enjoyed this conversation, don't keep it all to yourself. Share the link to it on your social, especially LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and on Instagram. And when you do, tag us in so that we can say thank you for sharing the episode. And if you're feeling really generous, give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. They're really helpful with getting the pod out to more designers. Well, that's it from me. Enjoy the rest of your day.